Coming to you from the AT&T podcast studio, this is Long Story Short. I'm Ted Struley, the executive director at Oklahoma Watch. We're a statewide nonprofit news organization that specializes in investigative reporting. You're listening to our weekly podcast, which lets you hear directly from our journalists as they provide deeper insight into their recently published stories. Reporter Paul Moniz has been watching budget talks at the Capitol, but after the session's halfway point, Republican lawmakers from both chambers are not yet on the same page. Paul, what's the latest on the budget negotiations?
Yeah, so last week was another committee week in the legislature, and that was kind of chugging along. And then towards the end of the week, we kind of had dueling press conferences from both the House Speaker, Charles McCall, and Senate Pro Tem President Greg Treat about issues having to do with the budget.
So the Senate has a whole new budget process this season. Treat's talked a lot about that. Tell us about it.
That's right. Yeah. So as part of the transparency efforts by Greg Treat, it's his final term as pro tem. And he would like to kind of have a base from which to go on from the future. And so he had a new process for the Senate where basically they had met after they got the equalization numbers in February, had all the subcommittees meet, have everybody kind of in a public meeting, usually every Wednesdays. Subcommittees pushed up their numbers to the full Senate Appropriations Committee, and they came up with their own kind of spreadsheet that they kind of did in real time during those budget hearings in the first part of session. And then they sent that as a resolution over to the House as kind of a starting point for negotiations.
Now, remind us how much the state can spend on budget appropriations for this coming fiscal year.
Yeah, so the latest estimates when the Board of Equalization met in February had about $8.6 billion in certified revenue. Now, they have generally about a total of just over $11 billion. They've got some leftover money from last year and some ahead of expectations money that came in from the current fiscal year. So there's a decent amount of money left, but the Senate has said that part of that already for fiscal year 25, which starts in July, has already gone to the elimination of the state's portion of the sales tax on groceries.
Now, what do lawmakers say they want to fix from the current budget year?
Yeah, so part of the press conferences recently last week was basically a difference of opinion on how to fix a lingering issue from the fiscal 24 year. There was some teacher raises and staff raises for school districts for they were off the formula. Those are the districts that get a lot of local money and don't get too much state funding. And so there was a little litigation kind of possibility back and forth on putting those raises into effect. Now, the teachers got the raises at the school district level, but the state has not reimbursed those off-formula school districts. And so there's a little bit of an issue that's left hanging over from the current year fiscal budget that they have to figure out. And so basically the House Appropriations and Budget Chairman Kevin Wallace said, look, we can't figure out fiscal year 25 until we figure out how to fix this issue from fiscal 24. So they're working on that right now. And that's about almost a $16, $17 million impact that would be on that they'll have to figure out before they figure out the next steps in the budget.
So what else is holding up the negotiations?
Yeah, so there's that. And there was kind of a dueling expectation of who had spreadsheets. The Senate had sent their budget resolution over to start negotiations with the House. They also sent their spreadsheets. Appropriations chair in the Senate, Roger Thompson, called the committee meeting last week and said, we're not going to hear any House appropriations bill until we get a spreadsheet. And so there's a lot of back and forth on whether or not that spreadsheet is coming, when it should come. And that's, they kind of see that as a kicking off point for additional negotiations. Now, the House has said that, look, the Senate sent us a resolution over, but that budget resolution and the budget bills they sent us don't add up to the spreadsheets they sent us. So they're kind of figuring out how to do that as well. So it's kind of a lot of back and forth, a lot of dueling press conferences. A session that was kind of chugging along has kind of stalled out a little bit last week over these issues, but they seem to be still talking. There was some back and forth shuffling of office visits late last week and this week. And so we're probably going to see some movement on that pretty soon.
So explain a little bit. They keep saying, you know, we want to see the spreadsheet. What's on the spreadsheets that they want to see?
Yeah, the spreadsheets are basically a very detailed breakdown by each agency in each cabinet kind of area of how much they're willing to spend for fiscal year 25, which starts in July. And that, of course, would have a little bit inclusion of supplemental stuff that's kind of had come up in the current fiscal year that they have to fix. And also, there's also, you know, how much do we put in savings? We do have surpluses. The rainy day fund is full. There's a couple other savings funds that have to be, that are pretty full as well. It's a decision by the lawmakers and leadership on how much they want to put those in savings too. And so that's still going on in the background in terms of dueling spreadsheets. But that's always kind of a thing at the Capitol, spreadsheets, paper, whatever. It's always a difference of opinion on what the numbers actually mean.
And so really what they're talking about is just they want to see the details. They want to see the breakdown, not just the summary numbers.
That's right. Yeah, they want to see exactly where the money is going to in each agency, as well as kind of each cabinet area.
Now, a lot of the budget negotiations, despite committee chairman, really tends to be driven often by the Speaker of the House and the pro tem in the Senate. How are McCall and Treat getting along at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, it's at times in the past it's been a little fractious, but they say that there's very cordial relationship, respect each other professionally for sure. They do have differences of opinion that they find out about, obviously either from their committee chairman or directly when they don't want to hear bills. But they claim that they have stopped or they have not resumed weekly kind of breakfast during sessions. They used to do that in years past. They've both said that has stopped, but they're still visiting each other occasionally. A lot of the communication is kind of coming from their budget chair people in each chamber. House Speaker Charles McCall said some of this could be, you know, cleared up with a text rather than calling a press conference and kind of putting a position out there. For his part, Pro Tem Greg Treat says, look, you know, we're not holding anything hostage. We're just basically responding to stuff that we expect from them. So they're getting along pretty well. It's just one of those things during session. You kind of see sometimes it fall off the rails a little bit, but usually they get back on track, and they're both committed, obviously, to getting their work done in this session. Have not heard any rumors of possible special sessions or extended concurrent sessions. So right now we seem to be in good shape. This might just be a bump in the road.
One of the points that they've differed on as the year has progressed has been tax cuts, right? That McCall says we're in great shape. We have a ton of money and he would like to reduce taxes for Oklahomans. Treat has said the grocery tax is it. That's all we can afford. We're going to be responsible and not dig ourselves a hole, right? Just because we're in the black right now doesn't mean it'll stay that way. So what are we going to see the rest of the way? Is there any chance of any more tax cuts, or is this pretty much going to stay where it is?
Well, definitely Senate Pro Tem Greg Treat has said that the grocery tax elimination on the state side is the only big major tax cut that the Senate will take up this year. He's held pretty close to that. Now, he left that open a little bit from me, from the outside, that there may be some smaller stuff around the edges. There may be some bills that might trigger some stuff on the personal income tax side if certain revenue levels are met, which we've done in the past before. Remember, both of those leaders went through the pretty tough times, 2017, 2018, getting into a little bit into 2019 of really bad revenue pictures. And so they would like to not have that for future leaders and kind of have their legacy be riding the state's fiscal ship. And of course, for his part, Governor Kevin Stitt has called for a path to zero for the income tax. Now, getting there would be a long way, probably in a long time. That's a huge chunk of revenue for the state. But he is still committed, along with the House Speaker, to getting something done on income tax this session. We'll wait and see. I don't see anything huge happening. Like I said, maybe a trigger bill if that is amenable to Treat and folks in the Senate. But we'll kind of wait and see on that.
All right. Thanks, Paul. We'll see what the rest of the session brings between now and late May. You can read all of Paul's coverage of state government on our website, oklahomawatch.org. Keaton Ross covers democracy and criminal justice at Oklahoma Watch. Last week, he reported on a gubernatorial task force that reported some recommended changes to Oklahoma's campaign finance rules. Keaton, how much money was poured into Oklahoma political races during that last statewide election cycle in 2022?
Around $80 million. Of course, 2022 was the cycle where most of the statewide offices were up for re-election, including the governor's office, as well as over 100 legislative seats. So a lot of a lot of races and a lot of money poured into those races.
Now, what percentage of that money came from what we call dark money groups, groups that are not directly affiliated with the candidates?
Nearly half of that $80 million total, around $33 million of that, was spent by these outside groups that aren't coordinating with the candidates, but also aren't required in many cases to disclose their donors or how they're putting that those ads information out.
Now, how does that outside spending in that 2022 cycle compare to previous similar election years?
If you look at 2018, it nearly more than tripled, actually, from 2018, when there was around $10.5 million of those independent expenditures spent. So really accelerated and targeted. A lot of that was spent on the governor's race, as well as some other it appeared in some legislative races, but a lot of that centered on the governor's race.
Now, what kind of issues have emerged with that huge spike in spending from outside groups?
So a lot of the issues that have arisen of this comes from just the content of the ads. Of course, if you'll look back to that period of the fall of 2022, it was hard to watch TV or listen to the radio without being bombarded with a lot of these messages, and some of them were communicating things that were misleading or in some cases not true. There was one advertisement that I don't believe it ultimately hit the air, but it was saying that Kevin Stitt commutes from his mansion in North Edmond to the state capitol by helicopter, and trying to drum up some outrage over that when that was not true. So a lot of issues about truth in advertising and the fact that if there's no paper trail on who is funding the ads or who's behind the group, that they will continue to make outlandish claims without much accountability.
Now, back in November, Governor Stitt called a task force to study Oklahoma's election and campaign finance rules. He was pretty unhappy about some of those ads and some of that money coming in from other places. That, as I recall, kind of motivated the formation of the task force, right? Who's part of that group?
That's right. As far as the sort of the unhappiness with some of the messaging, I know he mentioned that in an interview he did with the Oklahoma Watch staff before the governor's election, and also referenced it in his State of the State address after he was ultimately reelected. As far as who's serving on the task force, it was 9 members, mostly Republicans, including Election Board Secretary Paul Zierix, and former Republican Party Chairman A.J. Ferrati was the chairman of the board of the task force.
What were the big changes that the task force recommended to curb some of that dark money spending?
The major change recommended was lifting contribution caps to candidates. So as the current rules stand, individuals are limited to contributing $3,300 per election cycle towards candidates. The task force in its report basically said, if the Ethics Commission were to lift that cap, more money would flow directly to candidates, where there's a paper trail and some accountability on where the money's coming from, as opposed to the independent expenditures. That was the big change there. There was also another proposed change that would raise the amount you can contribute to a candidate without having to report it from $50 to $200.
And if any of the task force, if any of their suggestions were adopted and there were changes to the rules, who has to enforce that?
That would be the Oklahoma Ethics Commission. It was formed by a vote of the people in 1990 and has pretty wide authority to enforce ethics rules and reporting spending in elections. They've struggled with getting funding from the legislature to adequately do their job. I believe it's a staff of around 5 people right now, tasked with monitoring all these elections and spending and whatnot. So it will be interesting to see what, if any, funding bump they get this session, as well as if they work towards adopting or considering some of these rules that were put forth. Ultimately, the legislature or the governor can object to any ethics commission rules that are proposed, and there's a process laid out for that. But they can introduce those rules and try to implement them without getting a bill passed or that sort of thing.
The Ethics Commission has been pretty vocal about their frustrations with the lack of funding and how short-staffed they are, and how much they have to do, particularly trying to monitor some of the dark money that's flowing into the state. They even lost their executive director over that issue not too long ago and had some turnover at the top because of those frustrations. Do we have any idea yet if the rules proposed by the task force would make it, would that lighten the load on the Ethics Commission, or would that give them even more they'd have to do?
So as it's currently written, it seems that it would likely add to some of the work they have to do. And there's another recommendation in the task force report as far as wanting more monitoring of local elections and you know, races at the county level, municipal level, that sort of thing, where there's reporting required, but enforcement of what's being reported has kind of gone by the wayside just because of money not coming in. So overall, what the reports, the sort of monitoring and stuff that's recommended in the report, they would likely need some more money and some more staff to accomplish that. And it'll be interesting to see if they get any kind of a bump in the next state budget.
In their report, did they recommend any changes to the state's election process?
There were some incremental minor things that they recommended as far as the process for returning ballots from overseas voters, of overseas military personnel, that sort of thing. But overall, they were pretty complimentary of Oklahoma's election processes. We haven't had many issues as far as claims of election fraud and that sort of thing. There has the greatest concern they expressed was actually just some of the misinformation about election processes and that sort of thing that has accelerated in recent years. So most of the recommendations centered on campaign finance, that sort of thing.
All right. Well, thanks, Keaton. You can read Keaton's coverage of that task force report, as well as all his other work on democracy and criminal justice. You can find it on our website at oklahomawatch.org. While you're there, you can subscribe to Keaton's weekly newsletter, Democracy Watch. Jennifer Palmer covers education for Oklahoma Watch, and she's been covering the St. Isidore of Seville Catholic Virtual School, a topic taken up by the state's Supreme Court recently. Jennifer, remind us how this case ended up being heard by the state Supreme Court.
This is a storyline we've been following since the school was proposed, and last year, the statewide virtual charter school board approved the school's application and secured a contract with the school. And shortly after that, the state attorney general, Gentner Drummond, asked the Supreme Court to take a look at it. Basically, what he is asking them to do is to invalidate that contract, which would, you know, not allow the school to receive funding or to open.
Now, what's the attorney general's argument to that point?
Several. The main argument is that it violates state law and the state constitution, which requires all public schools to be non-sectarian or not associated with any particular religion. This school, of course, is Catholic and, you know, would be Catholic in every way. I mean, the students would attend mass. They would, you know, learn Catholicism in the teachings of the school. So not just, you know, associated with the church, but actually very much religious teachings in the school. But also, you know, he has brought up the argument of the U.S. Constitution as well, and says that the school would violate the Establishment Clause, which, of course, you know, prohibits the state from establishing any particular religion.
And that's often been interpreted to mean that if the state is paying for some kind of religious affiliation, that they've essentially adopted that as a state religion. That's kind of the argument there, right?
Exactly.
What's the school side of the coin? What's their argument?
Right. So they have argued that there are a couple of U.S. Supreme Court decisions in the last few years, three, actually, that they've brought up that kind of open the door for this type of school and to receive this type of funding. You know, in the court hearing, they called that the Trinity several times, these three court cases, and really said that, you know, those seem to pave the way for this particular type of school. But they also, you know, brought up this idea that I hadn't quite heard before, that this school is very much not public, was sort of the argument, even though they are requesting, you know, public authorization, public funding. They kind of drew this line that because it's a charter school, it's very much privately run and should be handled as so.
Did you get a sense of what the justices were considering or which way they were leaning when you went and heard the arguments?
It was pretty difficult to get a real sense of how they're leaning just based on their questions. But they did have a lot of questions and at times, you know, interjected in the attorney's arguments to ask questions. They, you know, spent a good bit of time asking about kind of related programs and whether those, you know, that are already in effect would, you know, potentially violate the state constitution or kind of how those related. Things like the Lindsay Nicole Henry Scholarship Program, which, you know, provides scholarships for students with special needs to attend a private school, like private hospitals was another comparison brought up. You know, if we provide state funding to, you know, say St. Anthony's, does that violate this constitutional protection for state funding? And so, yeah, those were some of the things. We also heard one of the justices ask very bluntly, you know, is this a test case? And that was something that their attorneys had to address and said, no, absolutely not. But the attorney general said afterward, yeah, it absolutely feels like a test case here.
So what was the atmosphere in the courtroom? Was it contentious? Was it tense? What did it feel like?
It was very crowded, as you would expect. This case has a lot of attention on it. There are a lot of attorneys involved. Of course, the attorney general himself did the arguments for the state, which is pretty unusual, I think, for him to take it on himself. And then, you know, both the school and the board are represented by a slew of attorneys from out of state and in state, you know, big national firms, DC, you know, so there was a lot of attorneys there, a lot of folks wanting to hear these arguments and listen. I also found it kind of interesting that the statewide virtual charter school board, you know, of course, is this entity that authorized this school. Only two members were there, and those were the two that voted no. All the yes votes were not in the courtroom.
The three that were not there that voted in favor of the school, are they still on the statewide virtual charter school board?
They're not, actually. One has moved to Texas, resigned, and the other two have joined Governor Stitt's cabinet.
What's the status of the school? Is St. Isidore open?
So it is accredited and authorized. They have a contract. So they have begun school operations. You know, their board is meeting. They have a student handbook. You know, they have opened applications for the school. So they are accepting those applications and getting enrollment underway. Now, the funding has not, the public funding doesn't start until July 1st. So that's the part that has not yet, but they are using private funding, I guess, to get the school rolling.
What happens next?
So we'll be, you know, watching and waiting for this decision to come through. It does seem like it would probably come before that July 1st. That's a really big timeline that we're looking at because, you know, that's when they start getting the state funding. So the state Supreme Court could issue their decision any day. We'll be watching for that. And then I do expect, you know, whichever way it goes, for the other side to appeal.
Do we have a sense if the Supreme Court rules against the school and accepts the Attorney General's argument, and we would then expect the school to appeal to the Supreme Court? While that process is going on, that can take some time. Do we know if the school would operate on its own without public money, or if they would just put everything on hold? Has anything been said one way or the other?
I don't know that they could operate without public money. I mean, they have a contract to be a public charter school, and what the AG has asked for is for that contract to be invalidated. And so if the Supreme Court ruled in that way, it could really set up an interesting dynamic because the statewide virtual charter school board, of course, the three yes votes are now gone. And there are the folks who voted against the school are the ones that are there and could make that decision to invalidate that contract, you know, based on the Supreme Court decision. Now, that board is also being dissolved this summer. So you've also got that dynamic with the timing, you know, running really short for that board and a new board taking over authorization of all state virtual schools and other charter schools.
All right. Well, thanks, Jennifer. You can read all of Jennifer's coverage of the St. Isidore Virtual Charter School and all her other education coverage. You'll find it on our website at oklahomawatch.org. While you're there, you can also subscribe to her weekly newsletter, Education Watch. You've been listening to Long Story Short, a weekly podcast that helps you get deeper into the investigative stories reported by Oklahoma Watch, which you can find on the web at oklahomawatch.org. This episode was recorded at the AT&T Podcast Studio. For Oklahoma Watch, I'm Ted Struley. Thanks for listening.